Das ist Bern einfach. Jeden Tag die richtige Dosis Politik vom Nebelspalter. Kritisch und unabhängig.
Der Podcast wird gesponsert von der BFI Bullion AG, ihrem Schweizer Partner für frisch produzierte physische Edelmetall. Direkt ab Raffinerie zu institutionellen Konditionen. www.bfibullion.ch.
Das ist Bern einfach spezial. Mein Name ist Can Schäppi und mit mir ist der David D. Friedman. Er ist Ökonom, Physiker, Rechtswissenschaftler, Autor von zahlreichen Büchern und Sohn von Milton Friedman, einer der einflussreichsten liberalen Denker vom letzten Jahrhundert. Ich rede heute mit dem David Friedman über Freiheit, Liberalismus, die Rolle vom Staat und über sein Leben. Für das, weil er Amerikaner ist, wechseln wir jetzt auf Englisch. Professor Friedman, welcome to Switzerland. Welcome to this podcast.
Thank you.
You have been invited by the organization Students for Liberty as a guest speaker. Tonight, you will hold a lecture at the University of Zurich, where we already are, entitled Law Without the State Toward an Anarchic Order. That sounds quite radical. For our audience, how would you describe your political philosophy?
The usual term is anarcho-capitalism, more generally libertarian. In the context of issues that actually come up, libertarian is probably a better description, since even the one anarcho-capitalist I know of who is currently president of a country is not actually trying to abolish the government.
You're speaking of Javier Milei,
yes,
from Argentina, of course. Well, it might be said that if he's president of government, he can hardly abolish it.
Well, that's not true. But I think he's not going to. I don't think he has sufficient votes in the legislature to abolish the government, even if he wants to. But also, I'm a fairly conservative anarchist in that I don't think rapid change usually works very well. So the pattern that I would like to see is one in which governments get smaller and smaller, and more of the things people do are shifted to private institutions, to voluntary interactions, and hopefully that could eventually replace everything.
Could you give a few examples of the first things that are now done by the state but should be moved to private?
Well, there's no particular reason why money should be produced by the state. And there are lots of historical examples of private monies. At the moment, the cryptocurrencies are private monies. I don't think any of them is used as conveniently as ordinary currency is, but they could be as they become more common. I think that K through 12 education should not be done by the state. That seems to me one of the things where it not only is not desirable, it's desirable not to do it, because I'm not in favor of the government teaching the children the things the government wants the children to believe. I think in the U.S. at least, people who are against private schooling or homeschooling, it's a more extreme version, are worried that parents who have unconventional views will be able to pass them on to their children. And I regard that as a desirable feature, not an undesirable feature, because I don't assume that whatever is the common view in a society is always right. And I think that I'm in favor of intellectual competition, of intellectual diversity, and I find it interesting that the people, at least some of the people who claim to be in favor of diversity, are in fact opposed to diversity when it consists of some people teaching their children things that those people don't want taught. That I think the context in which people imagine it in the U.S. is mostly religious, that people assume that the reason to homeschool is to keep your children from learning about evolution. And I don't think that's in practice true. I think if you actually study the people who do homeschooling or the people who choose to send their children to a private school, that's not usually the reason. In my case, my views are, I don't adhere to any particular exotic religious view, but my political views and my parents' political views were not the norm of the society, and therefore I have some sympathy to people who want to make sure that their children don't get indoctrinated with what other people believe. But What other things? There's no particular reason why mail delivery should be done by governments. The point at which many libertarians would stop would be law and law enforcement. And part of the difference between libertarians in general and those libertarians who consider themselves anarchists is whether they believe that private institutions can replace the most fundamental functions, that is, creating a legal system, enforcing laws, and so forth. And
also security towards other countries, the military.
Yes.
Yes.
I think I have less to say about that one. That's in my view a harder problem, except it's a problem for only some countries, that all countries have to have some way of settling disputes, of protecting people's rights and so forth. There are many countries at different times who did not have aggressive neighbors. But I think for a country that has powerful aggressive neighbors, it may be very difficult to replace a government for national defense. My first book has a chapter called National Defense, the Hard Problem. Mm-hmm. And the third edition of that, which has an additional 100 pages, so it's a substantial expansion, has another chapter on the same subject. But what both chapters are basically saying is, here are ways you might be able to protect such a society, but they might not work. That in general, the problem that people, economists, refer to as market failure is the problem of situations where one person's action impose costs or benefits on other people. Mm-hmm. That the nice thing about a market system is that mostly you can't do that. That if I want to get your labor, I have got to offer you terms that you're willing to accept. If I want to get money for what I produce, if I want to get money for my books, I have to write books people want to read. But there are cases such as if you want to defend Switzerland, your defending Switzerland will benefit everybody else in Switzerland. You don't have a way of charging them for it. And therefore, the easy way of producing things, which is the way we produce cars and food and lots of other things, doesn't work very well for national defense. And that means you have to fall back on second best ways of doing it. And I've discussed the variety of ways that might work, but they also might not. That, for example, charity is one way in which we produce public goods today. That people say, I'm willing to give money to some organization, even though what it's doing will provide a benefit to everybody, not just to me. And there are various other ways in which we succeed in producing things that can't be simply produced on the market. But they might not work. So I would have said that the hardest problem is national defense, that law and law enforcement is what many libertarians think is a hard problem. But I've argued that there are ways in which you could provide that via market mechanisms.
Going a step back. Central to libertarian as well as in our anarchist theories is, of course, the notion of freedom.
Yes.
If we go to not to theory, but to practice, what are your thoughts on the current state of freedom in, let's say, the Western Hemisphere?
I think that is usually the case that things are moving in all directions at once. That is, the different things are... So, for example... The U.S. is moving away from free trade, unfortunately, but I think some other countries are moving towards it. In a sense, the most abrupt improvement in the state of the world in my lifetime was basically the changes in China after the death of Mao, that China was a dirt poor and very oppressive society. It is a moderately oppressive society now, but a good deal less than it was, and it's no longer dirt poor. It's not as rich as America or Switzerland, but it's a whole lot richer than it was.
Per capita.
Yeah. That is, I've seen different figures. I saw a figure, I think, for about 20 years after Mao's death, that per capita GNP had gone up 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's...
Significant.
That's... We normally say, well, the country is doing well if it's got a growth rate of 6%.
Yeah.
And a growth rate of 2,000%, not annually, but is pretty impressive. Yeah.
Looking to Europe and the United States, what do you think are the biggest threats to freedom? You mentioned already free trade, but
that is the biggest general threat to freedom in America is political polarization. That we are moving towards a society where people who vote for Trump mostly don't think very much of people who vote against him, and people who vote against him mostly think that people who vote for him are crazy or stupid or something. There was a famous quote from Hillary Clinton about deplorables and so
forth.
And I think that there's a problem in a democratic polity that, in principle, if you get a majority and elect your people, you can do all sorts of things, including trying to oppress the minority. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't always work. In Hungary, we had a case where you had a democratically elected government. That government, I am told, I'm not an expert on Hungary, did a lot of things trying to bias the political system in their favor, that they basically... Yeah. And it didn't work. That is, Orbán lost the election eventually.
After 16 years.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, of course.
But it's not clear how much of that time they would have lost if they hadn't biased it, that they originally won fair and square, so to speak. On the other hand, I think Venezuela was a case where you had a democratically elected government, which proceeded to, in effect, nationalize all the newspapers, take over the television stations to do various things. And as far as I can tell, if nobody else intervened in that particular case, the U.S. intervened, and it's not a free country yet, but maybe it will be, I think it would have been unstable. So I don't think, but in the U.S. case at least, one of the things that happened before Trump, in between Trump's two terms, was the use of the abuse, I would say, of law against him.
Lawfare.
Yes, that's right. And I predicted before he won this election that one result would be that he would do the same thing when he got into power.
Of course, yeah.
And he's been less successful at that than I feared, in part because he hasn't had the time to replace all the judges and prosecutors and such. And therefore, he tells the Department of Justice to get somebody, and they try to get them, and they don't succeed. Mm. But if Trump and his successors stay in power for a few more terms, I could imagine a situation like Hungary, in effect, where the power of the federal government is used to establish a undemocratic system. But I could also see the same thing happening if they lose power. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I don't think that the Democrats are any more tolerant of people disagreeing with them than the Republicans are. They just disagree with different people. So I can easily see even Democrats who are in favor of political freedom might say, well, we're in favor of political freedom, but we've seen what happens if the Republicans get into power. Mm-hmm. And if Trump's successor, if Vance or somebody else gets into power now, it's going to be the end of democracy. And the Democrats have been saying that for quite a long time, and so far it hasn't been true. But you can see that the belief that your opponents get into power will be the end of democracy is a pretty good argument for ending democracy yourself, for not letting them into power. So that's, I think, in the U.S. case, that I don't think there have been huge changes in the amount of freedom in the last 20, 30, 40 years. The big change was the New Deal in the 1930s, and that really shifted U.S. rules in a way which made them much more favorable to government power, unfortunately. Yeah. And that trend has continued, but I don't think it has intensified very much. And there are trends in the other direction, that there is increasing existence of voucher systems, which are systems where parents can take the money that would be spent on the public school for their kids and use it to spend it on a private school. Mm-hmm. That reduces the government's power over what kids are taught. There is an organization in the U.S. that I'm very fond of called the Institute for Justice, and they're essentially a public interest law firm, but a libertarian one.
Mm-hmm.
They're, I think, the only organization that I routinely give money to. And their most famous case, which they lost, unfortunately, was Hilo, which was a case where a local government seized people's property for a price the government set, not the price they were willing to sell for, in order to give it to a private firm on the theory that this was really legitimate state action because the private firm would pay more taxes, basically, than the private owners. And that one, unfortunately, the good guys lost the lawsuit. But one result of that was a lot of laws at the state level limiting the ability of governments to do that, mm-hmm. because they, Institute for Justice, in effect, won the public relations case, even though they lost the legal case. But they've won a fair number of legal cases of things like rules saying you can't practice a profession until you do things which are designed to make it harder to enter the profession for the benefit of people who are already there. So I think one of the cases was that in order to braid hair, as you may know, American blacks, a lot of them favor hairstyles for women, which involve a lot of small braids. And so there is sort of a profession mm-hmm. of doing the braiding. And there was I don't remember which state it was, but there was a state where the laws essentially said, in order to be allowed to do this, you have to meet all sorts of requirements and probably take 100 hours of classes or 200 hours of classes, that sort of thing.
That's trade unions that get such laws into effect, isn't it?
It can be a trade union, but it doesn't have to be a trade union. Arguably the most powerful union in the U.S. is the American Medical Association, that the American Medical Association, in effect, controls state medical licensing. Mm-hmm. And during the Great Depression, the AMA sent a letter around to all of the medical schools telling them that they were graduating too many doctors. And since the medical schools require customers and people aren't going to become doctors if they're not going to get licensed, and the licensing is formally controlled by the state governments, but in practice it was done by the AMA sending the state a list of the medical schools that it approved of, there were strong reasons for medical schools to listen to what the AMA told them to do. So that's not formally a trade union, but it is an organization which can use government power in order to benefit its members.
Mm.
And I think the same thing is true. When I lived in Chicago, probably still, in order to be a barber, in order to cut hair, you had to have, I think it was a couple of hundred hours of classroom instruction on how to cut hair. And I think it's pretty clear that, I think that in that case, there was a barber's union, I think, but that the reason was to benefit the existing barbers by preventing competition. So some of those things are decreasing. I think that, mm-hmm. and a big change in my lifetime, not recently, was the end of the draft, of the military draft in the U.S.
Still have that, but we don't go to war, so
yes,
it's a different thing.
But your draft, as I understand it, is in order to establish a situation where everybody could be a soldier, or at least all adult men. Do they draft women in?
No, they can if they want to.
Yeah, but they don't in fact.
But the men get a basic training in order to, they could be a soldier.
So the basic idea is that if somebody does invade Switzerland, you can raise a very large army very quickly.
That would be the idea, yeah.
Yeah. But it still is a restriction on your freedom. How long are you a slave in Switzerland?
It's 18 weeks basic training, and then 3 weeks every year.
Yeah,
well, unless you want to go to officer school or something.
Well, that's not nearly as bad as in many other places.
No, it isn't.
it's not as bad as what the US was.
Yeah, of course. Going more on the action side, what can we as individuals do to advance freedom and liberty ideas?
That's an interesting question. And I think the first step in answering is to realize that the answer is not the same for every individual. That it is usually the case that political movements spend a lot of time fighting each other, fighting themselves. That is to say, the Stalinists argue with the Trotskyites or try to suppress the Trotskyites, and the Trotskyites would suppress the Stalinists if they could, but they didn't control the government to do it with. And similarly, Democrats spend a lot of time arguing with other Democrats. And I think part of the reason that happens is that people think of there being a sort of fixed pool of resources for your movement. And if I spend them in the wrong way, if you have one theory of how to promote left-wing or right-wing or libertarian or whatever it is, views, and I have a different one, then from your standpoint, I'm wasting our resources. And I think the right view from a libertarian standpoint is that there aren't any libertarian resources. There are libertarian individuals, each of whom has his own resources, the main resource being yourself. And each of them, if I think that the right way to advance liberty is to write books, and you think the right way to advance liberty is to campaign for libertarian candidates, if I persuade you that I'm right, since you're not going to write any books, the result is that you stop doing anything to serve liberty. And similarly, the other way, if you persuaded me. So I think the answer is that according to the particular abilities and interests of a person, there are a bunch of different ways in which you can try to promote liberty. And one of the ways is a podcast. That is one of the ways is disseminating ideas that if you think about the political system in a democratic society, it is run largely on free information. That if you're a voter in the US or in Switzerland, you know that your vote has very little effect on what happens because you're one person. It has more effect in Switzerland because you have more local control, which is an advantage of Switzerland. But in the US, my vote for president has maybe one chance in 5 million of determining who is elected, if it happens to be an impossibly close election. Therefore, it's not worth my effort to spend a lot of time and effort trying to get the right answer. It makes more sense for me to say, what is the position that my friends support? What is the position that will make the people I deal with think well of me, whether it's true or false? And I think there's a good deal of empirical evidence that's how people actually act. There's a American academic at Yale Law School, Dan Kahan, who has studied cases where a particular belief is connected to group membership. So that if you don't believe in evolution, that probably identifies you with conservative conservative religious groups. And if you don't believe in evolution, that makes you look like an idiot to people who are not in those groups. And one of his results of his research is that people are more likely to agree with their group the more intellectually able they are, whether that means believing in evolution or not believing in evolution. What?
It's kind of counterintuitive.
But his point is that your real objective is not to find truth, because what is truth doesn't really matter to your tribe. It matters for private goods. If you're buying a car, you want to have a correct opinion of how well cars work. But if you're voting for a politician, you don't have much incentive to have a correct opinion on which politician will be better. On the other hand, you have a strong incentive not to say things that will make the people around you think you're stupid or evil or things like that. So in any case, his analysis at least suggests, and I thought it was very interesting reading about it, that if you're more intellectually able, you are better able to construct arguments for what you want to officially believe in, and more likely to know what they are. Anyway, but my basic point is that therefore the outcome of political activity in a democracy largely depends on the things that people already know. True or false. That is that free information, and information is not always accurate information, affects how people vote. So if most people in America, most people in America view tariffs as a way of protecting American workers from Japanese workers, they'll be willing to vote for people who support tariffs. If most people in America view tariffs as a way of protecting American auto workers from American farmers, because after all, one way of producing cars is to produce wheat, export it, and import cars. And a tariff is a tax on that way of producing cars, then it will be less politically popular to have tariffs. So one of the things you can do, and the thing that I mostly try to do, is to spread correct views about why various government interventions are bad.
But the problem there being that libertarian ideas have always been fairly hard to sell to most people.
Well, I'm not sure that's true for always. In the 19th century, when we called the view liberalism rather than libertarianism, I think there were pretty widespread support for liberal views. That declined at end of that century and beginning of the 20th century, unfortunately.
You have another topic. You have spent most of your career in academia.
Yes, correct.
And as a libertarian, you are part of a very small minority there.
Yes, correct.
How do you make sure in such a setting that your voice still gets heard?
Well, one of the things you have to do is to do work that your colleagues will respect, which doesn't have to be promoting libertarianism. Mm-hmm. One of the things you can do is to do work that your colleagues will respect that does in some ways promote libertarianism. For example, my most recent book is called Legal Systems Very Different from Ours. And a lot of people seem to find it interesting. And I started out with the basic idea was that all human societies face about the same problems. They solve them in an interesting variety of different ways. And they're all grown-ups. We ought to take seriously the solution to legal problems or political problems that people 1,000 or 2,000 years used. We can see how well it did or didn't work, but we shouldn't say, well, that was a long time ago and therefore everybody was stupid, because not everybody was stupid a long time ago. So the main point of that book was that it was fun to make sense of different societies. But one effect of it was that some of the societies that I covered had functional institutions which had less government involvement than the ones we're used to. And therefore, I spread the information of that by writing that book. And similarly, various of my academic work, some of it has nothing particularly to do with libertarianism, but some of it is work that is designed to appeal to my fellow academics, but also to support my political views. But there are lots of other things you can do that I would say one of the very successful people in selling ideas was Ayn Rand. And she was a novelist, not an academic. And I disagree with her about a good many things, but she was basically a libertarian, even though she didn't like that label. And similarly, I guess my real point is there are a bunch of different ways you could do it. If you were an entrepreneur who could find a way of running a private school that worked well and was much less expensive, that would promote liberty in the long run, because it would mean that non-government schools were more competitive with government schools. And if you're a newspaper columnist or a reporter, anything which affects people's beliefs is a similarly, if you can produce a private firm that successfully replaces something the government does. So, for example, when I was growing up, it was taken for granted by everybody that you needed a U.S. post office, which has existed since the beginning of the country. That is less clear now that we have UPS and FedEx and a few other companies which do at least as good a job as the post office of delivering parcels. And the only reason they don't deliver first-class mail is they're not allowed to. And so there are lots of different ways in which you can promote remote liberty.
If you don't mind, for the last question, I'd like to ask you a more personal question.
Yeah.
You are the son of Milton Friedman.
Yes.
Nobel Prize winning economist, very famous, at least among economists. Your mother, Rose Friedman, was also quite accomplished, I think. What was it like growing up in such a household? And how did it influence
I think
you?
I was very fortunate. I do not think my parents ever told me, we are right and you are wrong, and the reason is that we're older than you. That it was taken for granted that anything they wanted to say, I was entitled to dispute. And the question was who had better arguments. And most of the time they would have better arguments, but not always. So that was part of it. I think being treated by your parents as an intellectual equal, and I've tried to follow that policy myself as well. And my children don't agree with me at everything for some reason. They hold some mistaken views, but it's possible that my views are mistaken. Yeah. So that was certainly a large part of it. On religion, I remember that I was about 10, and when I had the first religious conversation I can remember, and I told my father that I had decided that it was more likely than not that God did not exist. And his response was that was his opinion as well. Never discussed this issue before. Now, I've since concluded that the argument I came up with at 10 was not a correct argument. I think there was logical error in it.
Well, you could forgive that a 10-year-old.
Yes, I'm still inclined to the same conclusion, but I'm not sure I think I can prove it. I think I was very lucky in that I had parents who did not believe that because they were older, therefore they had to be right.
That's a very nice ending. Sadly, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Professor Friedman, for coming to the podcast. Danke euch fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Das war Bern einfach.
Der Podcast wird gesponsert von der BFI Bullion AG. Ihrem Schweizer Partner für frisch produzierte physische Edelmetall. Direkt ab Raffinerie zu institutionellen Konditionen. www.bfibullion.ch